mother-daughter parenting learning opportunities. And again, I'm going to thank Erin for her support. And her support extended from everything from me asking her, do you think this would fly, and her polling people, to working with Jeremy on setting up the registration, to being the one who picked up the food at Bageltown this morning and brought it here and set up the tables and really everything else. So in absentia, thank you, Erin. And I also want to thank the Lifers, Greenbergers, and Lazaruses for sponsoring this morning. Much appreciated. Our topic, like I said before, may a Jew admire holiday lights. So before I introduce the first source from Rabbi Jack Abramowitz on the Jew in the City blog with his comments on enjoying holiday lights, thinking that, as he writes, pretty much everybody enjoys them, and yet feeling like there's something wrong with that. So I'm going to poll you. What's your sense of it? First of all, I'm going to skip the question of, do you think people enjoy them? But I'm going to go to the other question of, what's your sense of it? Good, bad, somewhere in between? What would you say to enjoy them? Yeah?
I happen to enjoy them. Until I saw this title, I figured it might be Jewish City Blog.
Uh-oh. So, I used to enjoy them. Yeah.
I feel like bad because it's good until I have to be not that old.
In what sense?
Because then you're going to start, not bad, but once you start admiring the holiday, it's not so Jewish-y, it's more Christmas,
Right, it could lead people to a greater affinity for Christianity. That's what I'm hearing from you. Chukos Hagoyim, which you referenced, or Chukos Akum, is a specific halacha against emulating things that non-Jews do, particularly if those are associated with another religion. So maybe that's going to be relevant here. Could be. There was a hand here. Yeah. So maybe you can enjoy them while understanding and appreciating this isn't our thing. Could be. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I think that you could just enjoy them for just the lights and just for all the decorations, but not specifically for the holiday. You shouldn't look at it and glare at it and the way of thinking of it as the idol, and instead look at it as just the beauty of it.
Right. So look at it as something beautiful, and not to kind of stare at it, right? Gaze at it, that kind of a thing. Could be. So what we're going to see is that on a very basic halachic level, ask the rabbi, am I allowed to? The answer is probably yes. But there's a broader issue here that is worth thinking about that's much bigger than the issue of lights, and much bigger than the issue of a particular holiday at a particular time, and it's how we think about our relationship with religions other than Judaism. And that's really why I wanted to discuss this, because I think it raises questions that are worth a lot of thought. So I want to start off by stressing something that we call in Hebrew, Darchei Shalom, the importance of having good relations with our non-Jewish neighbors. Because anything that we're going to talk about in terms of how we relate to the way they're celebrating their holiday has to be in the context of what's our relationship with them supposed to be. And in the second source on the sheet, I brought you a comment from the Rambam. Much of what we're going to discuss is from the Rambam. The truth is he's building often on things in the Gemara, but I find the Rambam's presentation to be concise and effective. And so I use that sometimes, the Shulchan Aruch as well. And I'm going to be reading in general out of my English translation of the sources, but you have the authentic original Hebrew there as well. So the Rambam writes, the Chachamim, the sages, have instructed us to visit their sick, and I added in brackets, meaning of people who worship things that, as far as Judaism is concerned, are avodah zarah, are idolatry. We're supposed to visit their sick. We're supposed to bury their dead as we bury Jewish dead. We're supposed to support their indigent people, their needy people, along with Jews, to promote Darchei Shalom, peaceful paths. And the Rambam brings you two psukim. The first pasuk, hopefully, is familiar from Ashrei. Tov Hashem lakol v'rachmav kol ma'asav. Hashem is good to everybody. His mercy is on all of his creations. And then he brings you a second pasuk from Mishlei. Derachei hadarchei Noam v'chol nesivosei ha-shalom. That the paths of the Torah are pleasant and all of her ways are peace. So I asked you a question on the source sheet. Why does the Rambam bring two psukim? Right? If you wanted to say, be at peace with the nations around you, you could have just brought the second pasuk. All of the Torah's ways are peace. Why does the Rambam bring the first pasuk there? What is he adding? There's something there that's more than just about peace. Rachamim, exactly.
And all of his creations.
And all of his creations as well. Good point as well. The first pasuk says, number one, that Hashem is good to everybody. And this is for, as you say, all of his creations, kol ma'asav, and that it's a function not just of peace, but also of mercy. And the difference between saying it's for peace and saying it's for mercy is because I might have assumed, if I just had the second pasuk, what the Rambam is saying is, we don't want a society where we are at war with everybody around us. On a practical level, it's not a good idea. And therefore, the Rambam is saying, you should make nice with the people around you on a practical level. But the first pasuk says, no, it's not just about practicality. Hashem is merciful. You ought to be merciful as well. It's about how you feel towards them. That we are supposed to have feelings of mercy upon those around us such that when they are in need, we take care of them also. And the Rambam brings you three examples here. It's a Gemara in Gittin. He didn't invent it. But looking after their ill, taking care of burying their dead and supporting their aniyim, supporting their needy people. So that's something that's really important to keep in mind when we talk about our attitude towards their holiday celebrations. The other thing that I thought is very interesting and worthy of a much bigger discussion sometime is source number three. The Rambam in this section is talking about religions other than Judaism, and what their role is in the world. Why do these religions exist? Why does God want them in this universe? Look what he says. He says, you can't really understand why Hashem does what Hashem does. He says, that's not happening. However, what he does say is, the deeds of, and he mentions the founder of Christianity and the founder of Islam, are meant to straighten the path to Mashiach, to prepare the world to serve Hashem in unison. The idea is, and the Rambam goes on to spell it out, I'm not going to read everything inside, if there are spare copies on any of the... Oh, there's a spare copy right here. You using this? Sorry?
No,
sure,
forget.
Okay. The Rambam writes that these other religions, Christianity and Islam, actually serve to spread knowledge of Hashem, of Torah, of mitzvos, around the world. And ultimately, in the time of Mashiach, people will recognize that Judaism is true. However, these are actually useful in bringing the world towards where Hashem wants the world to be. It's a really startling idea to see. It's a different way to think about Christianity and Islam. It does not make them okay for Jews, as we're going to see. But it seems to frame them in something of a positive light. There's a reason for them to exist, and there's something beneficial about them. Clear so far? Okay, so that's all background. So Christianity, from a Jewish perspective, is what we call Avodah Zarah. Okay, foreign worship would be a translation of Christianity. And I'll ask you, and I don't know how many people are here, certainly among the teen set of the parent-teen combinations, are that familiar with Christianity. But does anybody know why it would be Avodah Zarah? Why it would not be an okay thing for a Jew? Like, what is it about it that's different from us?
Their God is not our God if they don't believe in Hashem.
They think they do. No, they think they believe in the God of Avraham. Like, they think that they believe in a God who created everything and who is all powerful. We clearly have a problem with the fact that they believe.
There's Jesus also, that's an issue.
What's the issue?
Well, there's resurrection and there's.
Right. So when you get to some of the specifics is where you get into trouble. Right? This idea that God abandoned us, right, and said, I'm starting again with somebody else. And now this Torah is no longer binding. There's this New Testament. Right? That ends up being problematic. But that in and of itself would not make it idolatry. That would just make it wrong. There's a difference. Not everything that is wrong is idolatry. In other words, if you look at Islam as an example of it, they believe in a God who is not physical, who created the world. There's only one. Where we get into trouble with them is because they also believe that Muhammad is a prophet and he comes to cancel some of the things that Moshe said and change some of them. That doesn't make it Avodah Zarah. And there are many, many halachic authorities who argue that Islam is not idolatry as far as Judaism is concerned. Where Christianity gets into trouble is a belief in a trinity. The idea that, and I don't want to, like, I'm first of all, I'm not enough of an expert to teach Christianity. Second, I feel kind of funny teaching Christianity. That's not really my thing. But they have this idea of three entities that form God, joining God with other things. There is, in certain branches of Christianity, the idea of worshiping saints, human beings who supposedly performed miracles, bowing to certain icons and symbols. That's where you get into trouble. They may have an idea of God being somewhat physical, depending on which branch of Christianity we're talking about. So there, we run into things which, for a Jew, are definitely considered idolatry. And I brought you on the sheet. If you take a look at source number 4, starting in number 4. So that's part of it.
Yeah. They think the saints, they believe it
themselves. Yeah, yes. I mean, again, different branches of Christianity believe different things. A lot of what I just said is specific to Catholicism. So, you know, if you really wanted like to go in depth on Christianity as a Avodah Zarah, you would need to start distinguishing between, let's say, Catholics and sort of mainstream Protestant churches and, let's say, Unitarians, who are a different thing altogether. But the Rambam writes in number 4, this is from his section of his Mishneh Torah, his work of law, Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah. He talks about the foundations of the Torah. He says, the foundation of foundations and pillar of wisdoms is to know that there is a first, meaning an entity which was first, which caused all that is found, and that all that is found in heaven and earth and all in between is found only because of the truth of the one who made it found. All that exists is because God made it so. So you have to believe in God who was there in the beginning and who created everything. That's number 1. And in source number 5, this being is the God of the universe, master of the world, who runs the sphere with an infinite and unending force, an uninterruptible force. What he means by a sphere is a whole other discussion that I'm not going into. And he says, knowing this is a commandment. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. When Hashem says, I am Hashem your God, that is a mitzvah for us to accept this. And he says, this God is one, not two, not more than two, but one. And not one like a body which is divided into divisions and extremes. Since he has no body, that which happens to bodies does not happen to him. And what he means by that is, everything that's physical breaks down, deteriorates. All physical things fall apart. So if you believed that God had a body, then you would have to believe that God can ultimately deteriorate. So the Rambam is not good with that idea. And he says that is this idea that there's one God and not divided into parts and so on. He says that's a mitzvah. When the Torah says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, you have to believe that God is one. Yes, Dina.
So when you define Avodah Zarah, everybody thinks it's only bowing down to a tree, a pole, or something physical. What if somebody says there's 30 spirits that I think are God and I bow down to them and I don't see them? That's not Avodah Zarah?
No, it would be. It would be Avodah Zarah because he says it has to be one.
Right, so it doesn't have to be a physical entity. It could just
correct.
Be, I believe in 30 spirits running the world, 30 gods.
Yeah.
So that's Avodah Zarah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Correct. No, that's still Avodah Zarah, correct. And take a look at number 6, where the Gemara says it pretty clearly. One who joins the name of heaven with anything else is uprooted from the world. And he quotes you a pasuk, one who sacrifices to a god will be destroyed other than to God alone. God alone, there is no such thing as multiples. This is, one of the things, if anyone ever wants to, study this issue further, one of the things that's complicated is that modern religions tend not to believe what they believed 1,000 years ago. And what I mean by that is, if you ask many people who are Hindus, for example, do they really believe that all of these entities that they worship are gods? Many of them will tell you, no, these are just representations of a particular force. We're actually monotheist. Whereas historically, Hinduism was like the definition of the opposite of monotheism. It was multiple gods. So it gets tricky in terms of applying this in our day. But classic Christianity, with the idea that God is three, would have been out. Would have been idolatry for us. There's a lot of discussion about an issue that we're not going to go into, because then it would take much longer, of whether Christianity is Avodah Zarah for non-Jews. It's Avodah Zarah for us. Just like the Gemara in source number 6 says, we are not allowed to join God with other gods. But maybe that's not a mitzvah of theirs. Hashem told us, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. When non-Jews have a mitzvah of not worshipping Avodah Zarah, maybe that doesn't prohibit them from having a joining of Hashem with other gods. And there actually is a very strong school of thought to make that argument. But I don't, again, I don't want to spend time on that. We have enough things to worry about. But what we're seeing here is that Christianity will be considered a foreign religion for Jews. That's number one. Number two, what is the relationship between holiday lights, lights that you see on somebody's roof, lights on a tree? What is the relationship between those and Christianity? Anybody know where they actually come from? China. No, where the idea comes from. Where did this begin? So I did some research. God bless the internet. I did not have to go far. The origins are pagan, meaning there was a practice in Northern Europe, Germany, Scandinavia, of taking a special piece of wood, a log, today they call it a Yule log, and burning it in the fireplace at the time of the winter solstice, right, when it's very, very dark outside, and it was supposed to bring good luck. Christians borrowed that practice and made it a holiday practice. And at some point, unclear when, they combined that with the tree and started lighting candles in their trees. I'm told that this is actually first referred to in the year 1660. There's some document that describes Christians lighting candles in their holiday trees. In the late 19th century, Thomas Edison says, I can do that in a better way, probably a little safer, with electric lights. And that evolves into the use of these electric lights that they had in the trees. And once it's in the trees, let's put it on the house, and so on. What we didn't address is, so where the trees come from. Right? Why do they have trees in their houses? And that's also apparently something that they borrowed from outside. Christianity borrowed pretty much everything, right? All of their religion came from us in one form or another. And these other things came from other cultures, they had good taste in some of the things they borrowed. But the early Romans marked the winter solstice with a feast called Saturnalia, and they would bring in evergreen branches as part of the celebration. And the Celts, their Druid priests, also decorated their temples with evergreen branches, and hence the idea of an evergreen tree at this time of year, and they incorporated it into the holiday that they were already observing, and it looks like that's 16th century. So basically, if you were to see a Christian from 500 years ago, and you asked them about their tree and their lights, they would have no idea what you were talking about. Not about trees, and not about lights. Then they started on the trees. Then at some point they started lighting candles in the trees. And then at some point that became electric. And then it became something to put on the houses. And that's how the minhag developed. So all of this history is important. Because now I'll ask you, are these lights actually Christian?
Not from pagan. It's pagan.
It's a pagan thing. Except that they adopted it into religious practice. It became a symbol of it. Right? Normally, you don't see them up on somebody's house in August. And you might. Somebody's just lazy. or just really excited. So from a halachic perspective, the concern would have been that I'm not allowed as a Jew to benefit from that which is avodah zarah, that which is idolatry. That would have been, if there were an issue, a straightforward halachic concern, that would be the issue. If you take a look at source number 7, you see the Rambam quoting it based on a text in the Torah. One may not benefit from idolatry, its tools and sacrifices and everything made for it. You're not supposed to benefit from it. And the pasuk is, "V'lo saviso yaval beisecha," do not bring to'eva, a reference to the idolatry. You're not supposed to bring that into your house. And it's not only idolatry, but anything that beautifies it. Take a look at number 8. This is from the Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yosef Karo, who assuredly never saw a holiday tree because he came from Turkey and then he moved to Israel, and he lived among Muslims. And also, he was the middle of the 16th century, so they weren't lighting candles. They may have had trees. But he's not talking about that specifically. Rabbi Yosef Karo says in the Shulchan Aruch, one may not listen to musical instruments of idolatry or gaze at ornaments of idolatry, since one benefits by looking. And then Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who lived in Poland at the same time, says unintentionally listening or looking is permitted. You don't have to now go outside with your ears covered to avoid hearing the music in the mall. You don't have to do things that are going to make sure that you don't see it. So from there, it seems like, if I stopped there, from those two sources, from source number 7 and source number 8, saying you're not allowed to benefit from idolatry, and you're not supposed to listen to their music or gaze at ornaments of idolatry, what would you say? I hear a not allowed. I hear it depends on intent. What do you mean?
When I say not allowed?
Yeah.
Like, you're not allowed to purposely do it. It's obviously unintentional.
So you're viewing it as an ornament that beautifies idolatry. Okay.
If you drive your car down the street and there's 100 lights, you don't close your eyes while you're driving the car.
No, don't close your eyes while driving the car. That's a general principle. Thank you. Right. Mm-hmm. No, people will go to see them. So would that be a problem now? Because that's intentional. So here I point you to source number 9, which tells us pretty definitively that this is not a problem. This is Reb Shabsai HaKohen, also known as the Shach. It's a major commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. He says, one may not gaze at idols themselves, which are worshipped, to see their ornaments, but forms made for beauty and not for worship are permitted, as explained by Tosos and the Rush. So he says, if it's just made for beauty, even though it's associated with Christianity, even though it's associated with their holiday, it's still going to be allowed.
But they're not worshiping the tree. They're not.
Correct. This is not tree worship. That's correct. So it seems like, and I brought you a supporting source in number 10. We're not going to look at it right now. You can look at it right now. You can even gaze upon it. That's another source that supports the idea that the problem here is staring at it to enjoy it, as opposed to if you happen to see it. If there were an issue, it would be an issue of staring at it to enjoy it. It comes up in various areas of halacha. So, like I said in the very beginning, if you ask me the straight question, is a Jew allowed to admire the lights? Yeah. I think halachically it's permitted. They're even allowed to go and see them, wanting to go and see them. I think that it is permitted.
Is it the kavanah of the person also? Like, most people who put up lights have background that you just, they have actually no clue.
Yes.
They want their house to look pretty.
Correct.
Like, there's no intent whatsoever. Probably not even, most of them are even religious people by any stretch.
Correct.
They just want their house to look pretty.
Correct. And I think it's a fair assumption. There's actually a line like that in the Gemara's time, where they say that most idolaters of our day, the days of the Gemara, are not idolatrous at this point. It's just minhag avoseihem bidehem. They're doing what their parents did. So, you know, my parents did this, so I do it, and it isn't even actually idolatrous at all. You know, 1,800 years ago. You know, how much more so when you get to our day. So that's definitely a valid point. But I want to point to a bigger question and a broader concern that that I think is worth thinking about. The issue here, and it was mentioned by somebody before, is the potential that it can actually lure a person in. There are many sources in Judaism, and I brought you some examples on the sheet, of concern halachically that you might end up being drawn to idolatry in the event that you are exposed to it in positive ways. Take a look on the sheet and you'll see some of these. This is number 11. Gemara in Avodah Zarah quotes you a sentence in Mishle. Harchek me'aleha darachecha, or darkecha. You're supposed to distance your path from her. What is her? Her is a reference to minus. It's a reference to heresy. Don't read into it being called a her. Torah is also called a her. So, you know, it works both ways. But the point there in the Gemara is that we are taught that we're actually not supposed to walk near a house of idolatry. That's one example of it, to physically steer clear. Another Gemara, this is an interesting one in source number 12. People do this all the time. The Torah says, V'shem Elohim Acherim lo sazkiru. You should not mention the names of foreign gods. So the Gemara says, you shouldn't say to somebody, wait for me beside idol X. In other words, someone wants to know where to go, and you say to them, oh, go to the church and hang a right. Right? This Gemara is not happy with people doing that. In number 13, that's actually a mistake in my translation on the sheet. I was writing too quickly. You'll see. I'll explain. The Gemara says, "Asur la'adam sheyomar." One is not allowed to say, "Kamana ovedes kochavim zu." How attractive is that idolater? It shouldn't say idol, but idolater, to actually admire somebody who worships Avodah Zarah and to say, wow, that person is really attractive. Last one, number 14. Ma tamid lomar v'ibadetem es shema min hamakom ahu. When the Torah says that you're supposed to eliminate the name of idolatry, what does that mean? It means give it a nickname. Don't refer to it by its proper name. So all of these concerns, lest you become attracted to it. If we believe our Torah is true, and hopefully we do, you know, if we believe our Torah is true, why are we so concerned? Why are we worried that if I admire the appearance of an idolater, if I tell people that, you know, if I use the church as a landmark and say, you know, hang a right at the church, why is that going to draw me in to Avodah Zarah? If I, you know, to use the case we're talking about, admiring lights, right? Or I said, maybe you can, you know, just have in mind, like, this is, I admire it for being beautiful. I'm not interested in what it represents and what it's there for. Why are we so concerned?
It's a pretty slippery slope.
Maybe we get too comfortable.
Maybe.
I'm going to say maybe it's a stretch, but I don't want to say assimilation. But it's the start of, like, I've seen neighborhoods where Shom Shabbos person, they're kind of the light, but it's blue and white Christmas light. So they put up blue and white light, and it looks nice in Hanukkah time because we're blue and white, but I don't think of it as Hanukkah light. I think of it as they're using the Christmas light. I'm not saying it's sending them anywhere, but the little thing. Don't have barbecues with your, you know, non-Jewish neighbors.
So you're pointing to that last point, you know, pointed to the fact that we have in halacha certain issues like bishul akum, right? I'm not supposed to eat food that they cooked, right? That's in, you know, there's pas akum, the issue of bread they baked. But I want to point to two practical considerations. Two practical, aside from the overall fear of a slippery slope. Number one, we're a minority. And it's really hard to maintain your identity when you are a minority. I brought you an article that appeared in Time Magazine, you see, back in November, not dealing with Christianity, but dealing with Israel. Professor Bruce Hoffman at Georgetown. It's not easy to be Jewish on American campuses today. He says, it's not easy to be a Jew at an American university today. As one student tearfully explained to me, we're exhausted and we're beleaguered and no one seems to understand. University administrators have indeed mostly failed their Jewish students, staff, and faculty. Fears of imposing censorship, citing of First Amendment rights, have allowed to circulate freely on campus Holocaust denial, the invocation of white privilege to dismiss anti-Semitism, the rejection of the Jewish people's inalienable right to self-determination. How did it come to this? There is first the obvious fact that if Jews comprise only 2.4% of the United States population, Jewish students will invariably almost always be a minority on all but a few campuses. Even at universities where Jewish students comprise larger minorities, Cornell, Columbia, Tulane, they have often experienced the same opprobrium, the same disapproval that has been seen on campuses across the country. Being a minority makes it hard. No one wants to be the one person in the group who's doing things differently, who doesn't fit in. There's a lot of pressure from society, which isn't always negative pressure either. Very often it's positive pressure, by which I mean everybody is having a Super Bowl party. Everybody is having a Thanksgiving party. You see people who have zero interest in football. Zero interest in football. But it's a Super Bowl party. Everybody's doing it. And so they'll have deli or whatever it is that people have at their Super Bowl parties, or they'll go to somebody else's party. They have no clue what's going on whatsoever in the game. But, you know, this is what everybody's doing, so I'm going to do it also. And it's harmless because it's a Super Bowl party. Like, what's show me what's bad. So, of course, I'll do it. And the same thing is true for, or the fear is that the same thing is true for, some of their celebrations. People who start to go to this can then end up going to the next thing and the next thing. I don't like the term slippery slope just because I feel like it gets overused. But I feel like in this case, there is real reason to think people have something drawing them in this direction. And especially when, I don't know how many of you, you know, have friends, neighbors, whatever, who are not Jewish, but they're often very friendly, kind, charismatic, attractive people, and they want to invite you in, you know, have a meal with us, see what we do, type of a thing. They don't intend it in a bad way. They're not trying to hurt you. They don't, in their mind, what they're doing is not in any way negative. So that's one of the elements behind sources, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14 is saying you have to draw a line. Because if you don't draw a line, there's a lot of social pressure to take you in that direction. That's number one. And number two, going along with it, Rabbi Menachem Meiri, writing in 13th century Catalonia. So for those who are not familiar with what a Catalonia is, if you were to look at a map of Europe, you would see Spain down here, and then France over here. And in this era in which he lived, in the 13th century, Catalonia was actually its own independent thing, but kind of more allied with Spain. But some years it was Spain, at some points in history it was France. So I just called it Catalonia on here. The point is it's right near Spain, right near France. And in the 13th century, if you were Jewish and you were in northern Spain or you were in southern France, you were vulnerable. This was a period of time of forced debates between rabbis and priests to argue about the validity of the Torah. It was not a good time for Jews. So keep that in mind as you read number 16, where Rabbi Menachem Meiri talks about the idea of not using the name that everybody else uses for another religion. So he says, worshippers of idols, Asherot, and the like. Asherah is a kind of tree worship which is separate from, you know, the holiday trees. So they would give their idolatry an attractive name so that it would gain favor in the hearts of those who heard it. In other words, they didn't just call it Fred. They gave it a name that connoted something positive, that, you know, said that it was something good and benevolent. So a Jew who mentions it should use a degrading name, he says, to remove the heart of its servants from it and convert his service to that of God. In other words, don't say it in a way that it's going to be positive because you can be drawn into it. That's the concern. So it's something that I think people need to think about when they talk about admiring the holiday lights. When we were just, you know, during the breakfast time before we started the shiur, you know, I pointed out that we live at this funny time in history, in the sense that for most of our history, Christianity was the one that was trying to stamp us out, and Islam, at certain points, was actually our ally. And now we live in a world in which, thanks to what's going on in Israel, we have much greater concerns when it comes to Islam. And I'm not at all, please. I'm not painting all Muslims the same. That is not, I'm not trying to increase Islamophobia. That's not my point. My point is simply to say that we live at a time now when we're much more concerned about the Muslim side of things, and there's a tendency to feel like the Christians are warm and fuzzy. They're our friends. But keeping in mind that it's Avodah Zarah, and keeping in mind that that historically, unfortunately, a lot of Jews gave their lives rather than join it, it's something to think about when we talk about admiring the lights. Halachically, I think it's fine. But you have to ask yourself, where am I going with this? Who am I? What's my identity? How strong am I in my identity as a minority? I think that's it's worth thinking about. Two other questions, quick questions. One of which came from the article, and one of which came from this table. Question from the article. If you look at number 17, this is Rabbi Abramowitz's piece on that Jew in the City page. He says, finally, it should go without saying that even if it's permitted to admire Christmas lights, it will be prohibited for Jews to decorate their homes with them in December, as this would violate the prohibition against copying other nations' practices. To decorate one's sukkah with such lights, however, should be permitted, as the non-Jewish practice is specifically to use such lights in December. My question for you, agree or disagree, that it's okay to use holiday lights in your sukkah?
Mm-hmm. And it gives nice decorations to my sukkah. Mm-hmm. But it's not, my tent isn't even that.
Right. Hey, when I was a kid, everybody went to Brooklyn, and they got these tinsel things that, what did I know? They were hanging. It was either that or plastic fruit. So, that's what you had. But I didn't know that was something that, in December belonged on a tree. Like, it was just, this is what you used.
Also, you can go to a store and buy lights. Mm-hmm. That aren't Christmas lights.
Right.
They may look the same idea on the string or whatever, but it's not.
Right. So that's right.
I would say getting red and green light might be going a little too far.
It's very funny. I'll tell you something that I just remembered that you just reminded me of. When I was 11, I think, so my grandmother, this was the 80s, and it was very, very popular for women to make tefillin bags for their kids or grandkids to use. And you can tell, guys who grew up in New York at that generation, they all have these tefillin bags. And my grandmother, asked me what colors I would like. And I said red and green. And they looked at me funny. My parents looked at me funny. What did I know? I was a kid. So I said, no, that's, that's nice. So I have a blue and gold tefillin bag, but there's a crown on part of it, and the gems in it are red and green. That's a holiday tefillin bag. I don't know. They went along with it.
For the Rangers?
Sorry?
Went a red and blue for the Rangers?
No. I didn't think of the Rangers in connection with my tefillin. But apparently I did think of December 25th. I have no idea where that came from. But yes, your lights that you choose for your sukkah don't have to be evoking the end of December. I do worry a little bit that building positive emotional connections with our sukkah can also end up making us more sympathetic to holiday lights. I think that there is something to be concerned. Yeah, I'm not arguing with him that it's probably permitted, but I think it's something to really think about if it's identifiable that way. If it's really not identifiable that way, if it's clear, yes, these are lights, but they're not every light now has their trademark on it. Then I think you're okay.
It might be interesting also what kind of message it sends to kids, because I could see a kid walking in and be like, "Oh, cool, you bought Christmas lights?"
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
No, these are sukkah lights, really. This hopefully is okay to enjoy the lights, okay to admire the lights, but think very carefully about what we do and how we relate to Christianity to make sure that we don't get drawn in, because we are a vulnerable minority. And it's something which I think everybody, teens and parents, need to really think through. Thank you very much.